Get out of here. Okay, so let's go ahead and call the February 7th meeting of the Mill Creek City Council to order, and we will begin with the flag salute, please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We'll call Joanne.
Here.
Here.
Councilmember Kelly?
Here.
Councilmember Michelson?
Here.
Councilmember Cavallari?
Here.
Councilmember Todd?
Here.
Councilmember Vaughn?
Here.
Okay, first up is audience communication, and this is your chance to talk to the council about anything on or off the agenda. And we have Susan, how do you pronounce your last name? Paschke?
I'm Susan Paschke. I live at 13621 26th Ave Southeast in the notorious Heatherwood West subdivision, known for the chip seal issues. And I realize that this is not on the agenda tonight, and I apologize that I was not able to be here when this was. And I don't know if I'm beating a dead horse or if it crossed the finish line, and if so, in which place. But there were a few things I wanted to bring up for your consideration after reading an article in a local publication. The streets that run through Heatherwood, 23rd, 25th, and 26th, that run north-south, are all used heavily by students going to Jackson High School, so they are not your normal residential streets. Additionally, two of those are slopes, which with the chip seal issue have shown serious issues. The city manager as well as Scott Smith have come out and seen that firsthand. So I'm concerned about that. The 7 to 10 year lifespan of chip seal that allegedly was going to happen with the county, we're at 2.5 years out, I believe, now. And this issue was brought up with prior manager Armstrong at the time. I don't want that to get lost because the wildflower issue is on the front page, but this was brought up with a previous administration. Perhaps all those things you can do what you want with, but the biggest issue I have is that I live on that street and I watched the county lay this down. And I understand there are interagency agreements, but believe me, throwing good money after bad is not a good decision. And if the county can't stand behind their work, or there can't be a way to mitigate payment for sloppy work, and I do mean sloppy, there are things I can show each and every one of you that were done at the time it was laid down that have caused problems. I just am very concerned that you make a decision to go back to the same place that caused these problems to begin with. So I respectfully request that you really entertain independent contractors and get bids, and also seal the deal with satisfaction for any services that are redone, and hopefully that will include the Heatherwood West area. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. And that'll be on the agenda again February 14th, where we're going to take a second look, and the city manager will be reporting back. And that'll just be the second look, not expecting a decision, but we're moving ahead like we said.
It's not a dead horse yet.
Thank you. Hey, anybody else want to talk to the council tonight? Only once, twice? Okay, moving on, up to new business, low-impact development code amendment. City Manager.
Thank you, Mayor, members of the council. As you know, the council at your January 10th meeting had a work session to discuss the draft development impact ordinance. We talked a little bit about the process the council gave. Some comments gave some comments to the wording in the code revisions, and a summary of the council comments and actions taken relative to those comments is set forth in your agenda summary. The item has been to the Planning Commission, and their resolution is incorporated into your packet. One thing I wanted to just bring forward at your last discussion, we talked a little bit about some recent case law that's triggered some vesting issues relative to stormwater. So I've asked the city attorney to attend tonight and to provide you with a bit of an overview of exactly what that decision is, how it affects us, and how it pertains to this ordinance. And so I would have this as an agenda item slash work session discussion with Scott and I, Scott Smith, Scott Massal, and I all contributing as appropriate. But at this point, I'd just like to turn it over to Scott Massal.
All right. Thank you very much. Good good afternoon. Good evening. I'm gonna catch up with myself in many places today. So I left a memo on your chair just a few minutes ago, and I apologize that it didn't get to you sooner. But it is what it is, I guess. So on December 29th, the Supreme Court issued a 9-0 decision in the case of Snohomish County and King County versus the Pollution Control Hearings Board, and it had to do with the Phase 1 and Phase 2 permits that are part of the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, NPDES program. That's a federal program under the Clean Water Act, and it mandates that certain actions be taken to protect water nationwide. EPA has delegated the responsibility to administer that program to Department of Ecology here in the state, so the State Department is responsible for preparing the program that implements the NPDES. Department of Ecology has issued a number of permits over the years under that program, and Mill Creek holds one of those permits, and they're generally referred to as the phase one or phase two permits, and they're issued for municipal stormwater systems, MS4s they're called. So the issue in the case that has caused so much consternation had to do with whether or not developers that had complied with the old stormwater manual prior to the new LID regulations and that you will adopt in the ordinance that's in front of you tonight, and the stormwater manual that's adopted by those by that ordinance. The question was whether developers were vested to the old stormwater regulations under Washington's vesting rules. Washington's vesting rules are what's called a minority rule in the United States, but it's a bright line rule, and basically it says that if you submit a complete application for land use development and it's declared complete by the local jurisdiction, then you vest to complete that development project in accordance with the regulations that existed on the date of the application. There can't be any changing regulations going forward that would cause you to change the development program. There are some exceptions to that. Mitigation funds, mitigation assessments, for example, can be changed up to the time that they're due to be paid, and there are some other exceptions that aren't particularly relevant here. The PCHB, Pollution Control Hearings Board, heard this case originally and decided that the stormwater regulations that were being mandated by the Department of Ecology via EPA were not subject to Washington's vesting rule, and they made that decision because the NPDES program and the PCHB, sorry for all the acronyms, the NPDES program from the Pollution Control Board's perspective was that it was a federal program and was not a either state-generated program or a local municipal program. So essentially the board, I'm going to call it the board, the Pollution Board, said vesting rules simply don't apply. Well, the reason that's important is because the permit that was issued by the Department of Ecology in 2013 gave municipalities until December 31, 2016 enough time to adopt these new regulations. But whenever the regulations come into effect, they apply to, under the terms of the State Department of Ecology's permit, they apply to all the developments that submitted a complete application after June 30th of 2015. So a half a year in 2015 and all of 2016 would be subject to these new regulations that we're going to adopt tonight, even though that's not typical procedure in Washington. And it's caused a big headache, of course, because there have been countless subdivisions, plats, finding site plans, you name it, that have been approved by local jurisdictions all across Washington. And now the question is, do they have to go back and retroactively change their stormwater systems to and upgrade them to the 20, what are now, I'm going to call them the 2017 regulations. So that was the genesis for this short memorandum. The case was, as I say, decided on December 29th. Just on January 18th, two reconsideration motions were filed by Snohomish County and by King County. Those were the appellants in the original case. Those counties did not want the new regulations to be retroactive. They wanted the vesting rule to apply. The Pollution Control Board did not agree with them. They went to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals did agree with the two counties and overruled the board. They went to the Supreme Court, and the Supremes overruled the Court of Appeals and went back to the original decision by the board. So the reconsideration motions were filed, and they're pending. So the decision that was issued by the Supreme Court on the December 29th is not the final decision. So that's why the memo says that it is pending. And the final outcome is yet to be decided. So some of the things that I have said in here may or may not come to pass, depending on what the court does with the reconsideration motions. So I've talked about most of the summary issue on page one, the topic and the specific issue. The larger issue I want to mention, just because it deals specifically with the dates and it's important to understand those, the question really is whether municipalities must retroactively apply their stormwater regulations for applications that were made after this June 30, 2015 date. And if you submitted your application before that June 30, 2015 date, but you haven't started construction, then you're also subject to these retroactive rules. So that's the larger issue that is facing you. So tonight, presumably, you'll adopt some new LID regulations, and the question that the city staff is going to have to answer is, what do we do about this decision and how we apply those new regulations going forward? And that's pretty much the discussion on page 4 and 5. I've outlined there what I think are the common issues that we'll need to deal with as we go forward. A lot of this, at least some of it, will be dependent on the outcome of the reconsideration motion. But initially, Mill Creek has a set of vesting regulations. I attached them to the memorandum. They're about 3 or 4 pages worth, and basically it gives the director the discretion to decide when a complete application has been submitted, and when that happens, that's when a developer in Mill Creek vests to the regulations in effect. The time frame for compliance is pretty quick. If whenever the Supreme Court issues its decision, there'll be a 30-day period in which they will wait to issue what's called the mandate, and then the mandate will issue. And when the mandate issues, then that's the law. That's the law in the state, and we have to try to figure out how to be compliant with that.
Scott,
yes.
What's the norm in those situations? Excuse me. What's the norm in those situations with vesting rights? Do they override or supersede EPA guidelines?
No, I would say the answer to that question is no. Even before this PCHB case was decided by the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court went to great lengths in the decision. It's a pretty clear and straightforward decision, although it's complicated in its effect. But it's a pretty clear and straightforward decision. And what the court essentially said in its decision was that the basis on which the vesting statutes have their authority are a matter of state law and respective of local municipal authority under its police power regulations and other regulations to adopt environmental controls and regulations. So think of critical areas, wetlands, that sort of stuff, shoreline management programs. So those kinds of regulations, the court in this case says, are subject to vesting and remain subject to vesting. Building codes, plat and subdivision regulations, how wide your buffers are, how big your streets have to be, all of the myriad stuff that goes into a development, those are all subject to the state's vesting. What the court said was that these stormwater regulations, the LID stormwater regulations that you're going to adopt, aren't state regulations, and they're not local regulations either, even though you're adopting them. What they are is they're federally mandated regulations that come from the federal government down to the State Department of Ecology acting in the stead of EPA and then applying those and mandating that the jurisdictions adopt them. So that's how the court gets to the point of saying they're just not subject to the vesting statute at all. the benefit of Washington's vesting statute, minority view though it is that it does create a bright line. And you know, as a developer and a city, you know exactly what the regulations are when somebody submits a complete application, and you can define with clarity what the issues are that need to be addressed by a subdivision or other application, and what mitigation steps and other actions they have to take in the course of getting that project approved. Most of the rest of the country doesn't use that rule. They just let the rules get changed as they come along, and then developers have to adjust on the fly. But this decision here in this jurisdiction causes a problem, because not only does it say that the vesting rule doesn't apply, it indicates it's unclear, which is the basis for one of the reconsideration motions, that it could be interpreted to apply to things like the state's Shoreline Management Act, which is derivative of the Federal Coastal Zone Management Act. And so the question, you know, if the logic is not clear in this court decision, then people are going to start arguing that there are other programs at the state level that were formally considered to be vested rights that should not be considered to be vested rights. And, you know, that's gotten a lot of people upset because it's changing the way we look at the world. So I hope I answered your question, but let me know if I didn't. That's a little long-winded. So what the city's going to need to do is figure out what projects might qualify to be subject to this retroactive application. And essentially, as I've listed on the bottom of page 2, it's going to include all large-scale projects, long plats, short plats, subdivisions, binding site plans, planned area developments, commercial and retail projects, multifamily projects, institutional area-wide projects. There's a whole laundry list of big projects that are subject to stormwater control regulations that could fall into that two-piece timeline. They submitted their application after June 30th of 2015, or they submitted their application before that date, but they still haven't started construction. So it's those two categories that will determine what falls into that list. It also would include things like road construction, infrastructure construction, development agreements are particularly problematic because those are intentionally long-term agreements that are designed to ensure that a developer wanting to do something of particular significance in the city has a set of regulations that work for that developer and work for the city, meet the city's codes and guidelines, and that everybody can rely on that for a period of time, typically longer than what the state law allows. But under this new PCHB decision, that might not be true as to the stormwater, the low-impact development provisions of the agreement. The complication comes in if they've already constructed the stormwater, which is typically infrastructure that's put in before any development takes place on the site. Much of it is buried, lots of pipes and vaults and engineered things. That would then, we don't know, need to be torn up or replaced or revisited with a new set of vaults and impermeable surface standards and permeable surface standards. So the first thing is to figure out what's the universe of projects that this might apply to, and then I think the city needs to implement a notification process, because these people aren't going to know. They're not reading the advance sheets for the state Supreme Court, and they don't know that the rules have changed. So you're going to have to tell them that the rules have changed and that their project is one of the lucky ones that's involved, and that the city is working on whatever the city's solution to this problem is going to be. The city needs to figure out what the actual scope of the regulations is that's going to apply, and this is all tied up with the final decision the court will issue, so there's not much to be said about that right now. The council may need to consider, even though it typically doesn't like these, but it might need to consider a moratorium on new applications or on, I'm not sure about what I'm going to say next, but continued construction of a project under the old approval that would now not necessarily be valid as to this case, because we if it is the law that you have to apply the 2017 LID regulations, and the project is subject only to the 2013 regulations, they're going to have to stop at some point, or they're just wasting their money, and nobody's going to want to do that. So it's going to be an issue. There's going to have to be an enforcement process for the city to take these projects through some sort of review and approval process and enforce if they're recalcitrant and don't want to do this, have to figure out how to make that happen. There's going to need to be some code changes made with respect to the vesting statutes and with respect to, depending on how the case turns out, what the scope of the vesting statute and the vested regulations might be. And then I think inevitably you have to expect appeals and court challenges to all of this. And hopefully some other city will be in the forefront of that, not us.
Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw has some questions.
Just a couple comments and questions, and I happen to bring my
developer hat.
I agree with 99% of what he said, other than the decision being clear and straightforward. There are adjectives that I would use, but we're in a public forum, and there are reporters here, and it's being recorded, so I will not. This is going to present some issues for us to decide in the coming weeks. I mean, I think Scott did a good job of describing it. The issue, we're facing this in the county right now, where the county is interpreting the decision literally, so where you can have a plat that you've vested to the stormwater regulations, and DOE agrees it's vested, they're taking the position that if you come in for a building permit application now on that lot, even though you're not building any stormwater facilities on that lot, you've got to retrofit your storm facilities. The implications of that is, as Ecology keeps changing their stormwater manuals, the requirements for stormwater detention keep going up and up and up and up. So those big open space tracks where you have the vaults, they get bigger and bigger and bigger. Takes up more room, and our ability to provide affordable housing in our city or elsewhere goes further down the tube. Fortunately, Ecology does not even agree with the county's interpretation. But if the court somehow, I mean, we're going to have a decision to make possibly at some point of whether we literally interpret the decision like the county's doing. I think it's wrong. DOE disagrees it's wrong, but the county is apparently afraid of being sued for under the Clean Water Act under a citizen suit. The other question I have is, and I don't know who on the other side of the room might know the answer, and if not, we need to find out, how many projects are there that are vested prior to the June or July date in 2015 that have not yet been constructed? Because that's going to be important for us, because one of the places where the PCHB left room for local jurisdictions is to define what under construction means. So in the footnote they've said it means more than grading, I'm sorry, it means more than clearing the site, but beyond that they leave it to local jurisdictions to determine what is under construction, and that's going to be important, I think, to define not just for us, but for us, because I don't think we want to be in litigation with developers over whether or not they were properly under construction to essentially trigger the vesting. So clear and straightforward, no. Cluster blank, yes. It's a mess.
Yeah, I think Scott and Christy and I have met on this a few times and done a preliminary analysis, and I think, you know, this is one occasion where our size is helpful in that we've basically at this point, I will say it's not complete, but identified potentially three projects that would fall within the analysis, and two of those are probably non-issues because they're doing LID anyway. And one would be more significant, and so I've asked for some additional information. So we're still in that evaluation process, but we have begun that evaluation process, and we'll bring back an update later to the council. But I thought this was a good topic of not really just bringing you the changes, but really having more substantive discussion about the impacts of these changes. And how it affects city operations, and there will be work coming from this. I think Scott did a great job of describing just the steps that we have to go through that falls to staff at this point and updates back to the council.
Member Todd?
Thanks. Yeah, this is confusing and concerning, because I think we've got ourselves between a rock and a hard place, and it's not Mill Creek's doing. So I think one of the, we can't pass the blame, but I think we need to make sure that people appreciate this is not Mill Creek being unique or different. Mill Creek and every other city and the counties are all faced with this, and so it's going to be difficult for the developer, dormant community, or somebody who's developing one property. I'm concerned about somebody like Brian in his private life is in the development community, and they got lots of projects going on, lots of jurisdictions. They kind of get it, but somebody's doing one project, maybe from out of state, or maybe they're just an individual that is short planning a property. It's going to be a mystery to them, and they're going to be blaming Mill Creek for whatever we do. Rightly so, because they're confused. So if there's some way we can help people appreciate this is not unique to Mill Creek, and then have Mill Creek behave in a fashion that is similar to other cities, I think that'll also help some of the complexity. It's a communications issue, and I'm glad Joni's on board.
Yes.
Aren't you glad you started this week? I'm concerned, too, and I guess you answered part of that question. I was wondering how many projects this is. I'm surprised that the number's only three. That's good news if it's only three, but I think going forward we've got other projects. Luckily, in some ways, we don't have a lot of development in our city. There's a lot of development the county's got going on east of us. Sorry, Terry, that's you guys got lots of those going on. But I'm concerned some of these things are hard to go back and redo. It isn't just a matter of digging up, putting in a bigger vault. It's in the process of building the site. You've compacted the soil that was originally perked, and now it doesn't, and you can't undo the damage you've done. And so this is not going to be just a little bit bigger vault. This is also going to be, uh-oh, you no longer have this permeable soil that you had to have in the first place, potentially. But I'm going to ask the Scott in the back row, city engineer, in the past you've said certain parts of Mill Creek just won't perk anyway. They're not permeable soils. And so are there vast areas where this is not an issue and Mill Creek could say, Mr. Developer, sir, don't worry about it, because you're in a place that even if you would have dug a test pit, you would not have been forced to do LID, and you don't have to go back and do that now?
excuse me. I think this kind of ties into my overall philosophy that you almost don't really need to mandate LID, because if it's really feasible and practical, the developers will do it anyway.
Okay.
In Mill Creek, there's only a few areas where this is the case. There's some around the Heatherwood West Apartments. They're off Dumas Road, and around our Cook property, Dobson Remlard, in that corner of the city, and then also south on 527 at the Mill Creek Commons, the self-storage and the medical building there. And there's a second phase of that storage facility, which is Mill Creek Commons 2, and that's actually one of the three projects where, even though they may technically be in that vesting requirement, they're doing LID and infiltration anyway, because that it works for them.
Okay.
It's kind of self-reinforcing. But the areas where that's the case are few and far between in the city. It may just be more retroactive, kind of, not necessarily after the fact, but kind of a paperwork exercise to go back and prove that this isn't really feasible. Because a lot of the feasibility, there's a little bit of a discussion in the agenda summary on that. It's really kind of more investigative work to see if water will really soak into the ground. And the vast majority of the city, that's not really the case, and it turns out to be not very feasible anyway, but it's just kind of a paperwork exercise to get to that point. But that's where we're kind of uncertain and need to do some more investigation as to what this really means.
Yeah. Well, I'd hate to have us take on costs we shouldn't take on, but in some case, I wonder if it makes sense for us to say this whole area, Gateway EGOV or something or other, for instance, is you don't each have to do your own test pit, have your own hydraulic engineer out here.
I think we could definitely provide some guidance. The USGS soils maps are a really good resource where it's like, okay, here's a map. If you're in this soil type, then you probably have a pretty good chance.
Yes, but we have to not have to force them to go out and spend the thousands of dollars to hire an engineer and dig a pit just to prove what we already know. If there's some way we could expedite that process for them by sharing the results or doing some of the, make a predetermination based on where it is that we know this is not going to work, you're not going to have to go back and prove this. It's just an extra step. Like you said, it's a paperwork exercise, but if we make them prove, go out in the back and dig a pit at the vintage and prove that it isn't going to perk before we'll fill out the paperwork, that's kind of just an extra step. And if we could help them out with that some way,
I will say, as part of our current development regulations, they do, they're required as part of their preliminary drainage report. They have to do an analysis of whether low-impact development is feasible. But it's fairly...
Okay. So they've already got that.
Yeah, they've already kind of done it to some extent, but it may not quite meet the rigorous threshold in the new DOE manual that they may need to investigate. So it may kind of depend on the site and the situation and what treatment option they're going for.
But just to clarify, and Scott, correct me if I'm wrong, the newer, with each iteration of the stormwater manual, it increases the detention requirements regardless of whether you use conventional stormwater or LID.
Mm-hmm.
So simply using LID doesn't get you off the hook. It just says you don't have to do the conventional, which would be a bigger vault and take up more room.
Yeah, there's detention and infiltration. And infiltration, it doesn't work someplace in the city, but you always have to do the new detention requirements, right?
Yes, whether you're using conventional stormwater management or using LID techniques.
Yeah.
Yes,
that would help. You're right. It would help in that step, but I just want to make sure that there's no misunderstanding. You still have bigger requirements regardless of what you do. And to clear my for earlier points, I forgot Councilmember Ryan is here. My comments about the county were directed at the executive's office, not the council.
Becca, how's this going to affect our public works building?
We have not had an opportunity to have that discussion yet, so we'll bring that back in the context of that project. I literally have just gotten the legal analysis, and Scott and I haven't even had time to have a discussion yet. This Scott. And so this Scott and this Scott and Christy and I still have yet to sit down.
Can I? I'm going to beat a drum that I beat 3 years ago. Remember when we first started having the discussion about Jackson, and I was raising the issue with the Cook property and Dobson-Remillard, how the city sat on it? I mean, it is what it is. We didn't do anything. It's these unintended, when the city makes smart decisions to invest in property, but then the city doesn't act like a property owner would normally do. A lot of these things are out of our control. And we spent, that's why I hope we can get, I mean, it might be too late now, but I don't know how or if this will affect Dobson-Remillard, but sometimes these decisions come down that can dramatically affect what our expectations were. So hope we can get that back on the agenda soon.
Well, I think that applies. I think the Cook property is an example of it. I think the Cook property was bought a long, long time ago, but longer than before I was on council, and I think at the time, it's a 5-acre site, and it's less than an acre now, I think, is what it's come down to.
But still 5 acres.
But 4 of it is don't touch. Is there something that MRSC or AWC is doing in terms of citywide communication things that we can leverage off of? I'm thinking towards how do we help communicate clearly to people, and they've got resources probably, because I think lots of cities are having meetings like this right about now, maybe not with
and that is one of the reasons Joni is here, and we've talked about that. I think for us the approach is going to be determinative of the number of projects that are affected. What I have instructed staff at this point is I don't want to just send, a letter, and particularly if we're talking about one or two projects, then I want to sit down in person and kind of have a conversation and explain that. Of course, our situation is very different than the county situation. We're a multitude of projects. So I think the communication strategy will derive from the number of impacted projects.
Okay. Scott? Anything else?
No, I don't have anything else if you don't have any more questions.
So before you tonight is an ordinance implementing the Phase 2 stormwater permit LID requirements. And in your packet, you also have, of course, as referenced in that ordinance, the Planning Commission resolution that incorporates the appendices that set forth the actual amendments. Again, those were brought to you back in January. The changes you requested are incorporated therein. Of course, Scott's here to answer any questions.
Kelly?
Thank you, Mayor. I understand what's going on with the case, and I think it was very well explained. Thank you. One thing that I'm not exactly clear on, because we're going to be asked to, we're going to take a vote about passing the amendments to the Mill Creek Code. What are the implications if we don't adopt these amendments versus if we do? I think you've already gone over the part if we do adopt them. Are the developers that are applying for permits right now or that may in the future before, say, 2020, are they going to be held? Are they still going to be held to these to the 2017 rules that Scott was talking about? What is the impact of not adopting this?
Well, we have to adopt by virtue of our permit. We have to revise our code to incorporate the low-impact development requirements.
Okay. So that's not even a question. Great. Thanks.
So what you're looking for is a motion on Ordinance 2017-814?
Correct.
Questions?
Yeah, we've got some more questions. So, Scott Smith, thanks for addressing some of the issues. And then I've got a question. I think we clarified last time, or talked last time, and clarified that this low volumes, comma, low traffic surfaces was confusing. So now we've made it low volume traffic, I think.
Low traffic volume.
What defines low traffic volume? Is that something that is commonly known, or do we need to find that ourselves in this?
I think in some cases, it's actually defined in the stormwater manual. I think there are certain various classifications of roadways that maybe your 400 trips a day may meet the trigger for that low traffic volume. I can't recall off the top of my head the full listing of those in the manual, but I know I have seen that threshold defined in certain cases. It also triggers on various treatment options. That's kind of where it comes in. More frequently is if it's over a certain volume of traffic on a roadway, then it requires another level of water quality treatment. I think it's kind of like the term of feasible, where it uses kind of a broad brush stroke in some cases, and in some cases it's okay just to be as a relatively vague statement that it's kind of up to the agency to interpret, like a parking lot, versus like a very defined number on roadway classification. And if it is something that needs to be well defined, that's in the stormwater manual.
So I was going to say, if this is capital L, capital T, capital V volume, I would think a definition or a reference to where that definition would be held, it's in the stormwater manual, would be helpful so that people don't get that situation where, well, I think it's low volume and not, just for clarity. And so either if we need to define it in our code or have a reference in the definition section to where it's defined, I think that'd be helpful to have that bright line to avoid difficult interpretations later on, if that would help out.
Yeah.
I'd suggest that would be important. The other question I've got is with respect to, so that's roads, but this LID also potentially is going to apply to parking lots, sidewalks, driveways. What?
Yes.
Is there a limit below which we are not going to make people jump through the hoops to do this? Is there some way we can define that? I'm concerned about small projects, and I'm going to make us think back to the trial project we did in the parks a couple of years ago, where all the sidewalks were being buckled by the street trees, and so we took out all the trees and replaced all the sidewalks. If we did that today, we'd be required to put in permeable pavement, or would that fall under some threshold in terms of overall area? I'm worried about the little replacement projects. If you're patching the pavement we've talked about here, you got to patch it the same way it came. But if the little replacements are going to be troublesome, if we have to put in permeable concrete where there used to be regular concrete, just in terms of different maintenance and construction, and also the people not being happy with the surface.
Yeah, I think there's almost kind of two different categories there, so to speak. And there's in the DOE stormwater manual, there's actually a pretty well-defined flowchart as to what requirements you have to follow. And it really starts on kind of your definition of the site and what the existing impervious surface is. So say if we're doing a park project where we're taking out some sidewalks, we would define that project as the park area, figure out what percentage of impervious surface, which would kind of trigger a flowchart as to how we go and what applies where. And then it goes to if we have over a certain threshold, then it may trigger that we have to do, you know, pervious pavement if at all feasible, or if we're under that, then we don't have to. So it's really kind of well-defined, and it's tough to do a one-stop shop answer on that because it really depends on the situation and the scenario. But there's other categories where I could see it come into play with smaller developments. Like small short plats. We've actually had a couple of these in the city, but in those cases, it's actually almost been easier to implement some low-impact development stuff because they're smaller and can be more flexible. And again, it also kind of works out better for the developer where they can, they don't have to sacrifice that a large amount of area for something like an underground vault if they can get away with doing like a permeable pavement driveway, rain gardens in the yard, and then, you know, sidewalks, stuff like that. We've kind of done two so far. One is called the McDowell Short Plat. It's at the end, it's kind of in the annexation area off, I think, 133rd near Sunset Lane. That was a case where we really, for the public street, they just built a new cul-de-sac bulb, and then they had one existing lot and three lots around it. And in that case, they, the one existing lot, they just left as it is. And for the three new ones, they did permeable pavement driveways and then rain gardens on each lot. And we have the same case on what's called the Raj Gill short plat. It's kind of a weird panhandle lot around the racetrack off Heatherwood West. That's another case where if they had to do like a vault, they would basically lose a lot, but they were able to do three lots on there. The downside is that as an owner, you don't get a yard. You basically just have a big rain garden, and that's all you get as your yard.
Called a pool.
Yes, a little, natural pool. So in some of those cases, a small one is almost easier to implement LID than like a big one that would require, it's almost so big and so much impervious surface that you really have to do like a really big vault or get lucky with the right patch of soil.
Couple questions on section 3 that caught my eye. I don't know if Scott, if you know the answer to this. Does our critical area code allow the excavation, grading, or fill of a critical area or buffer?
Typically not.
Well, it's important that you say typically not, because if our wetlands code or critical areas code prohibits it, I'm trying to figure out how we can authorize the city engineer to allow excavation, grading, or fill if our critical areas regulations otherwise prohibit it.
Right. And again, some of that may be beyond us, and it may depend, again, on the site and the situation. If it's something like, you know, excavating into a Class 1 wetland, no, probably not. If it's into the buffer around a Class 4 wetland, which is much lower quality, to do something that needs to be done, like put it in a stormwater facility or like a trail, then that's something we would allow.
Well, is that, do we need to put in, unless approved by the city engineer, consistent with the critical? I'm just trying to make sure that we're not granting the city engineer authority to do, approve what the critical areas regulations otherwise prohibit. So it sounds like you're telling me that under the critical areas regulations, the city engineer does have that authority.
Well, I think just internally, it would certainly be a bigger process. I don't get blanket authority just to say, yeah, go ahead, fill that well in, that's okay. It's got to go through a much bigger process. With a development application that goes through both the Community Development Department and Public Works for a much bigger review. I don't have just blanket authority to go authorize that, but that's not, it doesn't really come through in this out-of-context statement.
I understand, but before you get to all that process, the code has to allow it, does it not?
It does, and I think our code does do that. I think it's maybe a struggle with this.
That's what I'm just trying to make sure of, because when I read this, I was like going, well, my understanding is we can't excavate, grade, or fill critical areas or buffers, and so I wanted to make sure we're not granting the city engineer authority that the critical areas regulations don't allow. So if you guys are comfortable that that's not the case, that just jumped out at me the way that was worded.
Yeah, I'm comfortable with that. Is that the case?
Go ahead. Good
now. Anybody else have any questions? So then can we have a motion to approve ordinance number 2017-814, please? We have a second?
I'll
second. Can we have a motion and a second? Councilmember Todd?
I'm really struggling with this, and it's troublesome. God, on one hand, we're required to do this. But I know we've also had some passionate input from our citizens about the quality of the surface, or the roughness of the surface of our streets and sidewalks in our neighborhoods. And I just fundamentally don't think permeable pavement is the right thing that we're going to be happy with. And I just happen to think from an engineering standpoint it is an idea that was somebody's cute idea, but it just is tough to do, and we are not going to like the product. And so I'm having a hard time voting for something that I know we have to do under the national laws and the state laws, and to keep our permit, we've got to do it. But they've wrapped LID around something that I think is fundamentally a poor engineering approach. So I guess logically I have to support this because we have to do this, but I just fundamentally, I'm not against LID. I think there's a lot of great techniques, but I think permeable pavement is something we're going to have an issue with. Both short-term, people are not going to like the surface, and long-term, it's not going to hold up. It's just costly and a bad product. So I don't know what to do about that. If anybody's got any advice on how I should vote on this, I'm open to hear it.
We're all in the same boat.
Yeah, this doesn't matter. I mean, now I'm going to sound like an advocate for LID. LID is a bucket of tools, I think Scott Smith would say, and permeable pavement is just one of those tools. And so for the little guy, this is going to affect a driveway, not a public road that we're going to be responsible in the long term for maintaining. I'm not sure I have a clear understanding how any of this applies to us and decisions we make on road surfaces.
I'm kind of looking out for the little guy too, though. Somebody's going to come in here and I want to replace my driveway, and are they going to have to put in permeable concrete because their driveway is old? And they're going to be mad at the city, rightly so, wrongly so, because now my kids can't roller skate on the driveway anymore, and it's the city's fault.
Well, I think we need to ask the right question, and I'm not sure this is addressed by any of the amendments, because we're not amending the entire code. We're doing selected amendments, and I have to assume that the city, and I haven't looked at the code lately, like the county has a threshold above which, and so I think that's really the answer to your question. We need to have an understanding. Those thresholds aren't part of this ordinance.
And that's why I was trying to figure out the threshold. And Scott said, indeed, I remember going through the LID class. There is a whole network of stuff, and you're right, there's a whole bunch of tools. I'm pro-LID. It's just I think this one tool out of the toolbox happens to be not a very acceptable tool in some cases. But that's what I would love this. If there was a threshold that said, the replacing the small section of sidewalk or replacing the driveway is not going to trigger these rules, I think we would do well with that. If it's the next driveway project and somebody's going to come in here and stand at that microphone and say, I'm mad as heck about this, this is even worse than chip seal, it's just not going to make people happy.
Yeah, my suggestion would be that we move forward with these because this doesn't involve that issue, but I think we should look at that because the other layer we have to keep in mind is anything we do has to be blessed by DOE. So we don't get to just change the manual and adopt thresholds that we would like to have without the blessing from above of the state DOE. So, but I would be interested too in looking at those separate from this to see what those thresholds are, to see if there is any room where it might make sense to look at making it less onerous on the little guy that you're looking out for.
Good suggestion. That makes sense?
Yeah, and I think Councilmember Todd raises, you know, a really good point that when we look at agenda items such as this, you know, it is really important to see how one item can impact other areas. And I think your example of the chip seal, you know, being maybe potentially unpalatable for citizens, maybe almost a mandate in another context. And so I think we have to draw that nexus into our conversation. So I think it's a good point.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Understanding that we're unhappy, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? Passes unanimously. Next up is a presentation of the Purple Heart parking designations. Do you want to do that? Or you want to have the city manager do it?
City manager can do it. I'm just voicing.
Boozing?
he's been squeaking here for a little while.
So this item was recommended by Councilmember Cavallari, and he asked the staff to explore the idea, and you can see in your packet, reserved, i.e. designated parking spaces for basically Purple Heart recipients, right, combat wounded, and you can see a copy of the signage. I asked the Chief of Police and the Director of Public Works to collaborate on a review of the project, And I think that the spirit and the intent of the project certainly is part of what Mill Creek values in terms of honoring our veterans, you know, as exhibited by our Veterans Day Parade, our Memorial Day activities. But we do have some recommendations. I think that it would be appropriate, certainly in city parking lots, city facility parking lots, to designate spaces to encourage private businesses with parking lots to consider implementing a reserve space. We're not recommending that on the public streets that we have those designations, primarily because it poses an enforcement issue. You know, if you're going to have a designated space like you do for a handicapped space, well, for a handicapped space, you know, there's a legal placard, and there's a way to enforce that. With this, if you have a designated space and someone parks in that and someone wants to complain and say, hey, someone's parking in this space and they're not a combat wounded veteran, there's no way for us to really have say, okay, well, show us your placard, you know, that shows you can park here. So I don't think it'd be appropriate to, from an enforcement perspective, and that was Chief Elwin's recommendation. I think there's a lot of what we call voluntary compliance types of parking that you see out there, you know, for a lot of jurisdictions have reserved spaces for maternity, you know, senior citizen parking, but it's all voluntary compliance. It's not an enforcement compliance. I do think one thing that's nice about this program is actually provide the signage. And I think we actually have some signage, too, that have been provided to us if we want to use it. And I think that was great. Some communities that have implemented this have even painted the parking stall, if you will, purple, and then had the purple sign put up. So the staff recommends, certainly as a council work session, but to the extent you want to do it, that the council wishes to implement it, that we would do it in city facility parking lots, that we'd propose a resolution for you to consider at an upcoming council meeting to encourage the business community to dedicate spaces, but that we not, from an enforcement perspective, have it on public streets. So is that a fair synopsis, Councilman?
I think you've, pardon my voice, first of all. I think you've put it very eloquently. I think it's a great first step in implementing the project. I think it's a win-win. Honoring our veterans, especially our wounded combat veterans, is an endeavor. It's very noble and it's very appropriate, especially with a city like ours and the large number of veterans as it has. I was approached about 4 or 5 months ago from a combat veteran, and he showed me, and I did a little research myself, how this has taken off nationwide. And there are a lot of cities, counties, towns that now have these with the purple stalls. One of our wounded veterans is also donating the signs, so it's not exactly going to cost the city a lot of money, and it really is a very nice thing to do. It's for all the right reasons that we do this. And if we're going to honor veterans, this is a great step. And I'm one of those folks that believes you can never do enough, especially for your combat veterans. You know, a veteran would never probably park in a handicapped spot, but he would happily have you honor him in a combat veteran Purple Heart spot or something like that. So thank you, staff, for putting this together so quickly. Truly appreciate it. And I hope we have a consensus on the council to move this forward. I think it's appropriate, and we're not a first on this, and it's the right thing to do. Thanks.
Okay. Any other comments?
I want to thank you for bringing it forward. I think it is a good idea for the staff prepared. I think it's great. I'm going to support that.
We want to move this forward, come back with a resolution at a later date. Bobbleheads? Mark? Okay, come back with
it. I think, Councilmember.
So the memo suggests that we would designate a spot in City Hall North and South where we probably have the space. And then I think we would go to the businesses. I know Home Depot's big. They've had veteran space for a long time. I think they're big on this program, too, and that's been kind of traditionally their deal. I could see Lowe's doing that. Somebody's got a fairly sizable parking spot, maybe Central Market. I'm concerned, though, that parking has been an issue a lot of places, and so I think we kind of, while we want to encourage this, and it's a great idea, the geography of our town center, for instance, is really tight, and so I agree not putting it on the streets, but I think we also ought to be careful we don't get spots designated that make things more difficult for other folks and then run into enforcement issues and just make it difficult for the police, because even if it isn't enforceable, there's kind of an expectation, gosh, I'm mad because that spot is full, I don't think that's a veteran, and the cop's driving by, and how come he won't respond? I just trying to keep the chief and his troops' life simple. So I think if we keep it simple where we can control here in our own lots, that's great. Suggested to the businesses, that's great. But we've got to be careful we don't make things difficult in a situation where we don't have big lots to deal with.
Right. I think on, like, the lots, maybe, the, like you said, the Home Depot and the Lowe's, those are private parking lots. That wouldn't even be involved with the enforcement.
Yeah.
Because they want to enforce it. It's a
private lot. Let's put one at the library because there's a spot right there by the memorial. We know that there just isn't enough parking at the library. And so as much as I would love to designate a couple there in terms of honoring our wounded veterans, it's kind of problematic. Same thing, sports park. Ooh, you know, it's, I don't know.
And the staff did look at your exact concern. And so City Hall facilities for right now, all we're recommending is City Hall North and South for that very reason. We don't feel like the library parking lot lends itself to that, or the sports. We are in complete agreement on that.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for bringing those forward, because that's true. They're already tight and complaining, and yeah.
Perfect. Hey, so is that enough direction?
Yes, we will bring the resolution back at the next council meeting or two, probably the end of the month. So we'll get working on that.
Okay.
Thank you, City Manager, and all the staff involved.
Sure.
Okay, next up is reports, and I don't think I have any. Councilmember Bond?
No report.
For Kelly?
No report, Mayor.
Councilmember Cavallari?
Our parks board was canceled for lack of business, so there's no report from
me. Thank you. Councilmember Michelson?
Just that I'll be attending the Art and Beautification Board tomorrow, and I will explain the discussion and kind of the decision we came with the North Point Park art. That we aren't going to be involved with that right now, and then also we'll be discussing our utility box wraps again tomorrow. So I will report back when I have more.
Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw?
No report, Mayor.
Councilmember Todd?
Thanks. I'll just say it once again. Friday, if anybody who has nothing better to do than drive to Olympia, it is a good opportunity to go down and see our legislators and kind of make sure Snohomish County is well represented. I think you all got that email. Apologize if we blasted you too many times, but we want to get the word out. It's 11-1 down Olympia. I'll be going. If somebody wants to carpool, I'd be happy to carpool with you. Second thing is, next week is the AWC, what they call City Action Days. I'm going to go, and our new communication director, Joni Kirk, is going to go. So we're going to drop her right in the middle of AWC stuff and make her listen and learn lots of stuff. I'm looking forward to that. We're setting up appointments to talk to our legislators, Hobbs and Harmsworth and Lovick. And so it'll be a chance for us to check in with them. So if anybody's got any particular issues or wants to say something, that's great. I don't see any particular issues that I'm going to go beat on their desks about. We're mostly going to check in and say hi and thank them for the things they're doing for Mill Creek and looking out for cities in general this session. But if there's something that comes up before we leave next Wednesday morning at O'Dark 30, let us know and we'll carry that message to Olympia. Thanks.
Manager?
Well, a couple things, before I get to a formal introduction of Joni, I just want to recognize Councilmember Michelson. She had contacted me, I'm not sure it's been a few months because I've got budget all in my head, but with some crosswalk concerns near the Mill Creek Elementary School in the Cottonwood subdivision. And again, a team effort. We brought the chief into it, brought Scott into it, all three of us have been out together and individually looking at kind of the concerns raised by moms to Ms. Michelson. And we staff worked on a signage plan, crosswalk plan, And those have been installed, and the council member reports that happy moms in the area.
Happy moms.
I did drive through the area today as school was letting out, and it was really nice to see the crosswalks being used, the flags being used, and by the kids and the moms. So I just thought that was a really nice community field project, so I wanted to commend Donna for that.
Well, thank you, and thank you for getting that done. I know it took a while to get the signs, but they were really, it was a really, I don't know if all the council members are familiar with where this crosswalk was. It's at the corner of by Cottonwood on Village Green Drive. There's kind of a faded out.
Okay.
And there were kids from our particular neighborhood that were trying to walk safely to school, and the moms had to literally get out in the crosswalk just to make sure these cars, well, as I looked a little further, the moms talked to me about it, and as I looked a little further, I realized there was no warning that there is a crosswalk coming. There is no crosswalk sign that points down that says crosswalk. So I asked the city manager, and Scott Smith and the police chief went out and drove it during the school hours where the kids were crossing, and it was very dangerous. And I take that crosswalk almost every day, and it's, you know, just not marked. It's marked, but not visibly. So anyway, after a while, we got all the signs up, and great big, those bright yellow signs with kids carrying books and pointing down and flags on both sides. And the moms are loving it, and the kids are happy that they made an impact and they got a safer place for our kids and adults to be crossing. So thank you for the good work on that. Appreciate it.
And we actually took that one crosswalk, and Scott mapped out where inconsistencies were along Village Green Drive, and so that's where it was several signs that came to be, so we made it consistent through there. So I think one of the things that amazed me today, looking at it being utilized, is the volume of kids.
Right.
I mean, it's probably 20, 30 kids at a time,
oh,
you know, with parents. So it was really a really worthwhile project. I wanted to also, I know the press release has gone out, but and some of you may have already met Joni, but tonight we have Joni Kirk join us and as our new Director of Communications and Marketing. She started last Wednesday, so she's still kind of getting organized. But I will say in the tomorrow will be a week, I guess, right? So the week she's been here, she has provided me with a draft social media policy, a protocol for media relations, an inclement weather procedure, and a template to use for the council for legislative updates. And so if that first week is any indication, things look really good. We are very, very fortunate to have someone of this caliber. She has 20 years of experience in this field, and having worked for two university systems as well as two private ad and marketing agencies in Seattle and San Francisco, and the Snohomish County Tourism Bureau, and having taught mass media and crisis communications for 4 years at the University of Idaho MBA program. She does bring just a wealth of experience. Her undergraduate degree is in communication. She also holds an MBA. And so just having that master's of business is a nice complement to our team as we're looking at our work plans and our projects. And so she'll become an integral part of the leadership team, as she really fundamentally has to learn all the projects and what we're doing and why we're doing it from a communication standpoint. But I have received a lot of phone calls from staff and from media that's had a chance to meet with her and spend time with her already about how personable she is and how much they've enjoyed those initial meetings. So I want to just take this opportunity to formally welcome Joni in front of the council. And I ask all of you that have not met with her to get your bios done for her to please do so, because we want to include them in the budget books that are going to print this month. And so time is of the essence. So please spend your quality time with her if you haven't already done so. And that is all that I have, Mayor.
Okay, thank you very much. Any audience communication? Fred, name and address.
Fred Philbrook, 1227 141st Street in Douglas Fir. I just wonder if the council is making any preparations for when Swift comes through on Bothell Highway. They have 10 stops. People are going to come from various areas, and are going to want to park their cars somewhere. Our shopping centers and our neighborhoods could come filled up pretty quick. I hate to see parking meters put on Trillium Boulevard and on Bob Leverett Highway. I hate to see cars get towed, but there's things that are going to be happening, and I'm sure the council's on the ball and probably considering things that could be done.
Thank you. We actually have a presentation from Community Transit on March 7th. Anybody else? Once? Twice? Okay, with that, we're adjourned. Thank you, everybody.